Working out of Casual Hall, was it considered an end to getting a permanent job in the beginning?
That's what they told us it was going to be. But then when they actually began to pick people for... See, B registrations are tenure-track registrations. If you're a B man or a woman with that kind of a registration, you're not allowed to join the union. But still, the A people are going to be picked from the ranks of the B people. And they told us that in the casual hall would be picked choices for the B list. And as it turned out, the first 35 picked, I think, the PMA head of the committee that was choosing got his mother and his girlfriend on the waterfront. Neither one of them ever worked a day out of the casual hall. And Arian got his sister from New York in, and she'd never worked a day out of the casual hall. Well, some of the women in particular, and guys, then sued PMA and the LW. And that straightened it out pretty much. So the people who sued got in the V list and in the union.
Was at the time when you came back, did Bridges still have his iron-fisted control of the union?
Well, this local has always resisted control from Bridges. And a lot of autonomy existed in this local. As a matter of fact, in local after local up and down the coast, there were higher degrees of autonomy. The way Bridges lived a very strange life. He never had the entire union with a bunch of A-sayers. Yes men. In the headquarters local, yes.
Local 10.
The union in 1942 and 3 and 4 had become over 50% black from 5% black. And the message to those guys was, look, you're not being Jim Crowed. There are no separate locals for blacks in this. You guys are being treated right. And so that marker Bridges picked up for years and years and years. And they were, in large part, an automatic yes vote for Bridges. They had begun to quit being that in 1962-61.
Yeah, that was part of
our firing was related to that. That is to try to intimidate and stop the losses, the defections. In this port, there were always pro-Bridges people, but not automatic. But Bridges had power that were... those powers made up for his loss of support in the rank and file. He had employer power. And I don't think you'd ever call him an iron-fisted, like... It wasn't a John L.
Yeah.
The industry itself won't allow for John L's. Coal could allow for a John L. because the isolation of mining villages. Bridges, when this, in 1959 and 60, when this local 13 here in San Pedro, Wilmington, Long Beach, rebelled against the automation contracts, he and Paul St. Cyr diverted San Pedro ships headed to San Pedro, to San Francisco, San Diego, and Wainini, and starved these guys out, and got that Yellow Dog contract, just for San Pedro.
And so did that bring San Pedro in line?
Yes.
And did they stay in line in the
70s? No. The 71-72 strike meant that San Francisco and San Pedro and all the ports on the coast were voting in majority against the second M&M two times. That is, the first first contract, they voted it down. They voted to go on strike 96%. Injunction Taft-Hartley Act, 80 days cooling off period after that was over. On the 81st day, they voted 93% to go on strike again. They voted down the next contract. Bridges came back with a third contract, still with the steady men clause in it, 9.43, and they had worn them out. It was the longest long short strike in the history of the country, and they voted for it.
So by late 79, was there still, I mean, by late 70s, say, when you start casual longshoring, is there still resentment among the rank and file, or was there still a militant rank and file opposition to M&M vocally?
No, not in that sense. There was still resentment over what had happened. But there's no sense in being mad all the time when there's nothing you can do about it. I mean, once you've lost, you best lay back and take it easy until the next time history presents you with an opportunity. Workers are very different than middle-class radicals or outside radicals. Outside radical wants to keep fighting and keep going and on and on and on. Workers understand, no, that isn't the way you do it. As a matter of fact, you'll get killed. I don't mean literally. You keep up that same tension and that pressure, and people are going to have to get rid of you. Mm-hmm. And your own people are going to get tired of listening to you.
Do you think that happened to Dave Arion? Anyway, I mean...
How do you mean?
Well, he was considered... considered on the left in the port, and he got the presidency of the local and hasn't been able to get it back since. I don't know how he's going to make international president.
I don't know enough about that to answer it with any kind of even intelligent hunches.
How about just the younger workers in general? What did you observe about younger people coming into the longshore industry? Were they coming in there happy to be there, or were they coming in there thinking about it?
They came in extremely happy, ecstatic to be there, and wanted to make friends with all the older-time longshoremen and have a wonderful relationship. And no opportunities were created for them to do that. As a matter of fact, they got stiff-armed. There was no education program about the union at all. At all. There wasn't a leaflet directed toward casuals about the union. At all.
What about young, other people coming in, hiring in as B people? Well, I guess they had to go through casual at that time, huh? Or some people didn't. I mean, there was no programs for any union people?
I don't think there's any that's ever been done for the B-men either. B-men or B-women. But certainly there was nothing for these casuals. Nothing. And it was a tremendous opportunity. Here the union, with the foundation of the C, the casual hall, the union had lost a lot of power. That is, if you're the agency through which extra men must be obtained, you can obtain them or not. If you do not, then the employer has the right to go to the unemployment insurance hall and get unemployed. But that's not as if they don't have the experience that these other guys have had for years, called upon this particular Douglas and this high school and that place and so on. And Christ, these guys are working, some of them, teachers are working, get 15 days a year pay, you know. They knew a little bit about the waterfront, thought it was great. And you know, it's built in solidarity too. Every time you give a striking local 100 jobs with these good conditions and independent and stand up for yourself and all that, boy, they made believers out of them. Well, that's gone. That's been negotiated away. What do we notice? I stand down there in that In the first 3 days of my going to casual hall in this town, I recognized, by count, 26 young men who work either in McCowan's Market, Harbor Office Supplies. One worked in the Denny's up by ahead of our street. Mm-hmm. It was a network of the whole Harbor community. These guys didn't live in, I bet not 5%, not 2% lived more than 15 miles from the port. Mm-hmm. And we could have had, they could have become the means through which the union reaches out to the total Harbor community. Mm-hmm. And it was just thrown away. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, a lot of guys feel very bitter from the kind of treatment they got.
Well, do you feel that the workers, the rank and file workers of longshoremen became less conscious, union conscious, or class conscious?
The kind of class consciousness I have run into that's, you know, really insightful and wisdom is been from the guys who went through the 30s and had time to do a lot of thinking. They were exposed to a lot of radicals, et cetera, et cetera. But then I've been exposed to the other kind of class consciousness that comes very rapidly at us. In a sit-down strike in particular. I led a sit-down strike that lasted 2 hours and some minutes. And, God, the education that took place in that brief amount of time was amazing. I don't see how it's possible for the guys who work out of the hall and are plug men to really, and plug women, that is, that's an old phrase, working off the plug. They used to have plugs with their number on, brass number. I don't see how it's possible for them to turn anti-union, because the minute the union is no more, that's the end of the low man out system of hiring, which is totally democratic, and it frees you not to have to sweat. You know you're going to get your proper democratic turn in line for the job at the right time, and you don't have to fight about it. What the danger is that the container yards will become the bulk of the employment. And the steady men working for just one company all the time will be so pressured that they will become unable to exercise solidarity with other people in the port the way they could when they worked out of the hiring hall. And we're headed towards a situation where the number of longshoremen will be skeleton crew in a port because of the increased, constant increases in automation. And I fully expect to see the day when almost all piers have armed guards and high fences. Matter of fact, most of them do now, but I mean a real show of guns on the part of the security force there. Because hijacking has become something, and the most important single segment of the working class today in this multinational period are the people in transportation, particularly longshoremen and seamen. They're the most important people any other local union anywhere can have an alliance with. Take the garment workers. The most important single ally they can have are the people who unload garments from China, Taiwan, wherever, Peru, onto the docks.
But how are people on the docks going to get this kind of consciousness about working class consciousness? That's what I'm wondering. Is that consciousness disappearing? Like you said, in the 34...
The job won't let it disappear. The job keeps it going. You become ignorant of a lot of the tactics of the class struggle. You become ignorant about history. But the class nature of the society you're working in doesn't stop educating you. And of course, when a crisis comes, you learn in a cubed manner. Not geometrically cubed speed, the education occurs at the time. The problem is if the number of longshoremen in the port get so small in number that they're far more easily policed, and we may run into a situation where captivity occurs, and this will be an ineffectual segment of the working class. That's a possibility.
Captivity, exactly what do you mean?
Well, let's say that there are only 300 longshoremen in the whole port, and they all work behind barbed wire fences or chain link fences with barbed wire on the top. No one can get into them. Yes, exactly. And already all the Teamsters all around them are non-union. They're Salvadorans. The Teamsters gave away that work to the corporation. And why they did it, you can only guess. But the Teamsters Union in general has given up their driving jobs and retained their non-driving jobs in the warehouses and so on in the factories. I think what happened was, through a loss of heart and courage, the bureaucracy of the Teamsters Union gave up the disputed, important segment of the work to the government and the corporations.
How long did you, what year did you continue to work in that, out of the casual hall?
84 to 86. And I was gone.
Now that you've sold the inventory of Single Jack and are a semi-retired man, what do you see yourself doing in the future as far as in the field of labor?
Well, I'm not semi-retired to begin with. That is, doing 2 to 3 books a year is full-time work. Retirement in the way that it's talked about in society is unthinkable. That is, where you just sit around and wait for the leaves to fall and your days to pass. This is me, this is what I've been doing all my life in one way or another, and this is what works for me, and this is what keeps me alive, and I'll keep doing it. I'm going to withdraw more than away from activity more than I have in the past, because you don't learn as much about what you're doing as you do by memory. When you start remembering, then looking back, you learn a lot more. And I'm going to, for the first time, start doing some writing on a full-time basis rather than publishing the books of others. And I'm involved with the Los Angeles Labor Networking Committee. Have been for several years now. That's a very important focus of my life as well. And what we're really talking about is the kind of organization that's needed in the multinational period, where unions have to become horizontal in their structuring, so that from rank and file to rank and file, you can have contact with others. You don't have to go vertically to the center in Washington, D.C. to get to a local that's across the street from you. Literally, the way the cannery workers of Terminal Island had to do. Here are two different canneries across the street from one another. They're both being attacked. They're both going to be torn down. Both going to be sent away. We're going to lose 2,000 jobs in the goddamn island. And they're both members of the same SIU, affiliated union, cannery workers. And in order to get their act together, they got to go to Washington to make real contact with the people across the street. It's ridiculous. They can walk across the street and just take people on quitting time and create enough solidarity more than that pink union has done in its entire life.
Are there any other unions that... you're not talking about disbanding the concept of unionism as we have it now, or just having alternatives for local union people as far as organizing?
I think it's apparent that the international unions, in every union, let's take it the way we can see it even in the public. We have 90 major international unions in this country. In not one of them is the president who is a champion of the people, who uses his or her power with the press to call press conferences and have press releases on things of importance to the population. Homelessness, poverty, loss of rights, loss of rights for senior citizens, all the good stuff that can be done by these people of power. And they're not doing any of it. And it works better without them. Like at Heister. That's just one example, but I think I can make a case for that right around. Now, it doesn't mean that you don't need communication on a national and international basis. As a matter of fact, what holds us from creating real international unions is this national-oriented bureaucracy of our national unions. For them to go overseas and really organize others making the same products as their own members is too radical a step for them to take. Only people for whom that's just standard and should be done and can do it are the rank and file themselves. Now, who knows? Nobody can go make these people do that. But it seems to me that given the lessons of life, that people finally do something about what they've learned. And I think what they're going to be doing is making a structural change in the way American unions are led. And it seems to me that that structural change will mean more autonomy at the local level by far than we've had since the formation of CIO. We gave the center 90% of the autonomy because they said we have to have this power in order to be able to strike at the corporations all at once. And they've done just the opposite. They won't move against anybody. As a matter of fact, an employer is free to pick out and victimize a local union, the people in it, and a workplace without any fear the international union is going to organize retaliations in other workplaces of the same corporation.
Is the no-strike clause the biggest hamper to union organizing and the power of idea of international unions?
That and its twin clause, that is the arbitration clause. And the rights clause, which is part and parcel of it. But I would say, well, by law, if you got an arbitration clause, even if you don't have a no-strike pledge, you have a no-strike pledge. Mm-hmm. If you have a no-strike pledge and no arbitration clause, you're better off for the law. But that's very long.
So is the future of labor organizing in the United States looking grim, would you say?
I don't think so. I think that it's, in solidarity in Poland, 10 million people were organized in 3 weeks because people crossed the street en masse and talked to one another instead of waiting for a rep with an expense account to finally get to them and come to one of their meetings where no one is in attendance over about 2% anyway. That kind of organizing, I think, is what's on the agenda.
And are we waiting for a time of crisis to do this, to have this kind of organization take place?
Well, of course, there's always a time of crisis will do it, but how do you define what type of crisis? You know, two things are essential, maybe more. One is, of course, just the knowledge of what is necessary, what we really need to be doing, and that's pretty much there. Two, the people who know what should be done have to be given an opening to do it with some kind of chance of escaping the axe. You need a ghost of a chance before people take it, make the gamble. They're not going to win, and everything is, there's no avenues of escape, and there's no chance of picking up a good stick or club, or, figuratively speaking, they're not even going to try. They're not dumb. But give them an opening, and you have a half a chance of survival if you take this step, they'll take it. So, it's not, have a depression, that doesn't mean you're going to get it right away. What are your chances of doing it and not getting capital punishment in terms of the workplace? And then who knows when that's going to come? I mean, we just had a step in the right direction of a terrible thing that's happened. The law is going to take away much of our ability to sue union leaders for failure of fair representation. The law is going to take that away. The law rules, though, in favor of and openly favors the union leadership against the rank and file. That's a consciousness that's going to be dumped right on us, that openly in this society they are favor over us. Contrary, the reverse, that's the win. The Landrum Griffin Act was passed. The Landrum Griffin Act was passed on the idea that the good guys in the society were the rank and file and the leadership were the nasty guys, the hardheads, that you had to victimize. And the rank and file revolts of the 60s showed it was the rank and file at the local level that were unreasonable to the employer and that the leadership was reasonable to the employer. And so finally we get open